KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Cell on a block, he hanged himself at dawn with a note stuck to the bunkhead.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo. I'm a co-host here at Prison Pipeline. And I'm very honored tonight to have Terrence Sampson back for a second interview. We've been talking to Terrence. Terrence was incarcerated in the state of Texas at the age of 12 and was sentenced to, did a 29 years of a sentence for homicide. And so we'd like to talk to Terrence tonight some more about the good work that he's done while he was incarcerated. He got a master's degree. He wrote two books. He got a bachelor's degree. And now he's on the outside and he's helping to do youth advocacy trying to do, the really good work to help prevent youth offenders. So anyways, welcome, Terrence.
I'm just a pleasure to be here again. Thank you, Emma.
Yeah, thank you. So, Terrence, just let's recap your story a little bit, first of all, just for folks who maybe this is their first time hearing. So you're doing a program now. What's the name of the program that you're working on?
The program I'm working on is called the AIM Project. And AIM is an acronym. AYM is an acronym for All Youth Matter. And what we do is we develop, curricula and, programming for at-risk youth. And we also, have a board game that we use to establish as a foundation of communication, with these youth, to teach youth empathy and the consequences of their choices.
Mm-hmm. And you're based in Texas?
Yes, we're based out of Texas.
But right now you're traveling around in the Pacific Northwest to help promote this.
Yes, that's correct.
Work you're doing with this. Yeah, that's great. And you have two master's degrees?
No, I have a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in literature.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, thanks. Sorry about that. A bachelor in psychology and a master's in literature that you got while you were incarcerated.
While I was incarcerated, that's correct. That's,
yeah. And you were incarcerated at the age of 12?
I was incarcerated at the age of 12.
Yeah.
For a violent crime I regrettably committed.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us again tonight for the second part of this interview. Let's kind of pick up where we were before. I'd like to, talk a little bit, first of all, just about the role that let's just for folks who haven't heard it, let's talk about why were you arrested and convicted at the age of 12, and what does that say about our criminal justice system that we're willing to send 12-year-olds to prison for life?
Well, at the age of 12, I had some anger issues that my parents didn't know how to deal with, that I didn't know how to deal with. I actually needed help that I didn't know how to ask for. And it led to me projecting that anger onto my victim, that I took her life when I was 12 years old, and I was sentenced to 30 years for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I had what was called a determinate sentence, meaning that a month before my 18th birthday, the judge would determine whether to send me to prison or to release me. So it wasn't like I had a sentence that automatically sent me to prison. You know, the determinate sentence, I had to go back to court a second time,
mm-hmm.
you know, right before I turned 18. You know, but because of the high profile nature of my case and the seriousness of my crime, I was sent to prison to complete my 30-year sentence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were talking during the break, we were chatting a little bit about the role that family support played in your time incarceration, and you mentioned a book that you've written two books. I think that's what I got confused about, the two master's degrees, because you've done so much since you're incarcerated.
Yeah, I try my best.
But you've written two books, and you said one of the books that you wrote was about your friend who
Commodore.
And you're mentioning that he didn't get that kind of support, the sort of support that you got. So let's talk a little bit about your parents. First of all, how did the crime that you committed, how did that affect your parents?
Well, I like to tell people that my parents are legendary in their support of me, because I'm the only man who was incarcerated for 29 years for a crime that he committed at the age of 12.
Mm-hmm.
And with that being said, my parents were there for me every day of those 29 years of incarceration. So they have the distinction of being the only parents that have had to support, you know, their child, you know, for 29 years for something that he did when he was 12 years old, you know. But their support for me actually helped me to get through and make it through everything that I went through while I was incarcerated. I believe that if, people commit mistakes that are incarcerated, if they don't have that type of family support, then they are at a high risk of becoming involved in a lot of negative and counterproductive things that go on in prison. You know, when you have someone coming to visit you, when you have someone, you know, sending you that letter, you know, every now and then, I mean, it's vitally important, you know, as far as help us to maintain and hold on to hope, but to also, you know, motivate us to want to, you know, do something different, you know, we want to know with our lives and, you know, turn that corner. And so the support that my parents gave me, not only did they encourage me to stay in school, but they also encouraged me to always remain focused on the end game, that this is gonna come to an end one day, you know, and you're gonna have to, you know, move forward with your life. You need to be preparing for that right now. You know, the guys that don't have that type of support, like, you know, my good friend Commodore, when you don't have people, you know, give me that positive reinforcement, you don't have people, you know, motivating you to do better, you know, then you lose that hope. You know, things become drastic, and like in his situation, he took his life because he felt like he had nothing to live for, 16 years old,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so when you don't have that hope, you know, it can be detrimental, you know, to a person's life.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that your parents did to show that they supported you while you were incarcerated?
For 25 years, I was incarcerated for 29 years, but for 25 years straight, my parents came to see me once a month, mm-hmm. regardless of where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was everywhere in Texas. I was in North Texas, South Texas, East Texas, West Texas. And if they didn't have the money, you know, they would go to the church, and the church would give them gas money to come see me. And not only that, but when I was getting my education, I had a grant. I was under the youthful offender grant that allowed me to get my bachelor's degree. But when I went to get my master's degree, I would have to pay for that master's degree. And so my father, who was a high school dropout, determined that, you know, he was going to make a way, you know, for me to have the money to get that master's degree. So he started a Janet King franchise, You know, and so my father, you know, he scrubbed toilets, you know, swept my floors to help pay, you know, for that master's degree, that sacrifice, that, you know, that he put in, you know, to make sure that I had a way, you know, to get my education. And so what they did, you know, I like to tell people that I don't like to prove people wrong. So I don't believe in that concept of proving people wrong, but I do believe in proving people right. And I wanted to prove my parents right for their faith and their belief in me and their sacrifices that they made, you know, in me. So that's the importance of that family support. You know, is that it makes people want to, you know, prove the people that love them right, you know, for their support.
You just totally blew my mind. That was like one of the most amazing stories I think I've ever heard on Prison Pipeline, you telling me the story about your father. That was just like so touching. That's amazing. Your father really loves you.
Yes, he does.
Yeah. Yes, he does. He must be really proud of you now.
Yes. It's almost like, you know, because I just had a son. You know, my son is 6 weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I look at him, and the love that I have from him kind of helps me understand the love my father had for me. You know, because in a time when so many men shirk their responsibility of raising their children, my father raised me from outside of prison. You know, I was in prison, but he raised me from outside of prison. And he made the sacrifices that was necessary to help me to succeed while I was in prison. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's an extraordinary man. I love him to death.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And we were talking before, they had support from a program from the outside that kind of, did they have any support themselves while they were?
What
are some of the issues that, you know, let's talk about that.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, that's the sad thing. You know, it's kind of better now. Mm-hmm. As far as like organizations that offer that type of support to the families of the people that are incarcerated, you know, because when I first got incarcerated, those type of organizations were non-existent. The only type of help that my parents got was from the church, you know, and that was pretty much like financially. You know, but to help them to understand, to help families to understand the process of what their loved one go through while they're incarcerated, you know, those organizations didn't exist when mm-hmm. I was out. So my parents, you know, they're also to me extraordinary in the sense that, you know, they waded through, you know, all the mess that they had to wade through to be strong enough, you know, because all we had was each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they dug in the trenches with me, and it was just us, and we had to figure it out, you know. And so their role was, you know, showing me that, look, we love you, we're gonna support you, we're gonna be there for you. And they should tell me that my role is to do the right thing so you can get out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's one thing about prison that people feel and realize is that you're not guaranteed to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a lot of things that can happen to you in prison, and not just from the, you know, violence, you know, but also from, you know, your health. You know, mm-hmm. you know, it's just, there's no guarantee that you'll leave prison, because some conditions in prison, you know, can cause you to become really, really sick.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of things that, you know, that can happen to you. And so my parents told me that, look, your role is just to be, you know, productive and come home, but we're going to be here for you when you come home. And that's exactly what they did for me.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, what, like, so people who, here in Oregon, we have a program, it's called the Family Preservation Project, and it's just one that I'm familiar with, that helps women who are incarcerated, like, maintain those really important ties with their children.
Wow.
And, you know,
that's great.
And I'm not that familiar with what kind of programs are out there for men in men's prisons, but it sounds like that's like one of that's your story here. Sharing this story is a testimony to the need for funding for programs, and
Absolutely.
Really for the creation of programs that support families. Because
Absolutely.
It sounds like, at least with your story, the role that your family played in you surviving incarceration. I mean, you're imprisoned at the age of 12. You're incarcerated for 29 years. And your family was there for you the whole time, and that's really what helped you survive.
Absolutely. You know, so there's definitely a need for, you know, the attention of the programs that do it.
Uh-huh.
And if the programs don't exist, you know, to understand that, look, we need to try to create these type of programs. There's a program that I just went to speak at in Las Vegas, Friends of Incarcerated People.
Mm-hmm.
Family and Friends of Incarcerated People. I had a speaking engagement there last week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. You know, they try to be the support group for families that have a loved one incarcerated. And so groups like that, there's definitely a need of people, because, you know, people don't like to talk about it, But there's the victim's family, but the family of the person that committed the crime are victims as well.
Yeah.
You know, they have to go through a grieving. They have to go through a process.
Right. It touches everyone.
Yes. You know, it touches everyone. Mm-hmm. And so they are also in need of support. You know, my parents, when I first got incarcerated, you know, they lost their home. You know, I put my parents in debt, you know.
They lost their home? Lawyer.
Yes, oh, wow. They lost their home because I committed my crime in that house. Uh-huh. You know, and they went in debt, you know, paying for my lawyer. You know, they faced many, many financial challenges. And, you know, had it not been for the church helped them out. But the emotional toll, you know, the whole situation, you know, someone. And then it's like they're fear for me. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what was going on with me in prison. Okay, well, you know, what is it like? What does he have to go through? What is the process? You know, so to have people that can help, you know, families understand, okay, well, this is the process. This is what he's going through. He has to go through diagnostic. Then he's going to get his unit of assignment. Then once he gets to the unit, you know, you can go online and see the different type of educational programs and units have. Encourage your loved ones to get in this, to get in that, get in that. You need that. That mm-hmm. would be vitally important, you know, as far as, you know, helping the family to understand what their loved one is going through, but also having their loved one to be able to have that support for the family as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. I'd like to talk a little bit about race, because race matters.
Absolutely.
And here in KBOO, we have a principle of beloved community, and we really want to prioritize ideas that like elevate discussion around this and really try to minimize the role that white privilege plays in our system. White supremacy is like rampant in our culture, and it plays such an integral role in how incarceration is done, how prison is done in this country. As someone who's been incarcerated and has seen the effects of that growing up in Texas, you know, being sentenced at 12 years old to a crime that like a lot of white children would probably not have to serve, honestly. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, just honestly share with me your perspective on the role that racism has played in your life.
Well, I believe that the people that create the policy are not the people that come from the situations or the type of living circumstances that, you know, children live and go through that commit the type of crimes that are affected by the policy that they create. And unfortunately, you know, the people that create the policies are not minorities. People that create the policies don't grow up, you know, in underprivileged households, you know. And so the reality is that, yes, you know, it is a distinct bias against, you know, minorities and people that are not of privilege, you know. And I believe it to be sad in the sense that if it was your child, you know, that had to deal with some of the issues, you know, that I've dealt with, you wouldn't want your child to have to go through what I went through, you know. But because it's not your child, because your child, you know, grows up in a different environment and is subjected to some of the traumatic experiences that I've been through, then, you know, that doesn't resonate with you as far as, you know, of you voting or trying to enact these policies that would keep children incarcerated. You know, and the sad fact is that, you know, mostly when I was at TYC, it was mostly minority children that were there, you know, that committed, you know, these type of violent crimes. You know, so whereas race does play a, does have an impact on policy, and it does have an impact on how long a person is incarcerated. And that's just the reality. Mm-hmm. You know, people, it's a hard topic to talk about. You know, but it's like, you know, the people
I appreciate
that,
it.
Yeah, but the people that create the policy don't come from the same type of backgrounds that the people are affected by the policy come from, mm-hmm. You know, and that's just the reality.
And when you were doing time in prison, I've heard that like a lot, especially in Texas and in other states too, that oftentimes the general population kind of gets segregated.
Absolutely. And so I have a story to tell. I was a peer educator in the Gang Renunciation and Disassociation Program. It's a program in the Texas prison system that allows guys that were in administrative segregation for being confirmed gang members, or for guys that was in administrative segregation for violent acts against other inmates or officers, it allows them to get out of administrative segregation. And so when I first got to the Rams unit in 2008, I had a real good friend. He was a peer educator that was a part of this program, and he invited me to become a part of the program, right? And so I didn't know what to expect, because I'm like, okay, these guys are getting out of administrative segregation. You know, I just want to be there. You know, I had been locked up at that time almost 20 years. And so I just wanted to be a support system for them as they reintegrated back into population, because they've been in the isolation cell 23 hours out of a day, you know, for 10, 15, some of them 20 years.
Oh my God, really?
Yes. And so, you know, and so it's like for them, you know, just like, you know, when we're released from prison, there's a reintegration process for us to get out of prison. Well, for the guys that's been in administrative segregation, there's a reintegration process for them to come back.
Right, just to get into general population.
Yeah, to general population. And so I became a part of the grad program. And so my very first class, the classes are phase two is when I had them, anger management, because I ended up becoming an anger management facilitator for some of the, you know, the most violent men in the state of Texas. That was in segregation. And so it's a 16-man class.
Mm-hmm.
And so my very first class, 16 guys walk in, 8 of them were white, 8 of them were Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's like, and the white guys got the swastikas and the lightning bolts. This is Aryan Brotherhood, Aryan mm-hmm. Circle, White Knights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then on the left side, you got the Mexican Mafia, Texas Syndicate. You know, and so it's like, I'm in this classroom and I'm the only black guy there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the nature of prison is that, you know, it's three different doors that you go through in prison. You got the white door, the brown door, and the black door.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we, and you're going to naturally, you know, associate and assimilate with your own race. It's just natural what happens,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, and it's sad, but, you know, it's just reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, me being there, you know, I got the, you know, the white guys on one side, the Hispanic guys on the other side, they looking at me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, and so we had an open, and I used to have an open discussion, like every first class, like my very first class I did it, and then every class after, I used to ask them, you know, okay, well, how do you feel, you know, about me being here? It's, you know, open discussion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I used to get a whole bunch of, you know, a nigga can't tell me anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, this toad, and then I found out he used to call us toads, you know, it's different disrespectful terms they used to use,
mm-hmm.
And so I used to get that initially, but then what I did, and that's the importance of communication, and that's what my programs for the kids is based on, communication. See, when you establish the right type of communication with people, you know, to let them know that, look, I'm not trying to be a big eye and you're a little you. You know, we both on the same level. We both have, you know, different issues that you know, we're going in the same direction. See, when you're authentic, color doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're coming from a real level, color doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, and so that's what I kind of got across to those guys, and I taught those guys, and they end up trusting me. And at the end of 3 months, you know, I got guys with lightning bolts and swastikas hugging me, calling me a brother. You know, that's you know, and that was a very powerful experience for me.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we got over that barrier, you know, but it was because of, you know, good communication and,
yeah.
and them seeing that, look, I'm going through therapy just like y'all going through therapy. You know, we all in this, you know, this struggle together.
Wow.
You know, and so, you know, that was my experience of overcoming barriers of racism.
Uh-huh.
But that was just a isolated, you know, event, because generally, you know, in population, you know, it's just the reality is that, you know, everybody's going to see to their own race.
Yeah.
You know.
Maybe being an ad seg for like 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
Like just, I just, that's so cruel though.
Yeah. Terrible. So, I mean, 23 hours out of a day, you know, you get 1 hour rent. You know,
did you ever have to do any time in ADSEG?
No, I didn't.
Good for you.
The closest that I had to go to ADSEG was when I was stabbed, and I had to.
That was for your protection.
No, it was for while I was under investigation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, when I was under investigation, but I was in that 6x9 for like 13 days. And so when you are under investigation, you're stuck in a cell. But those guys, they lived the whole, and that's like a whole different world. I used to work back there. I was a janitor back there for like 2 years. They have a whole different world back there, you know.
It's, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a whole different
it's
world.
So I mean, I think it's so cruel. It's
absolutely
it's,
it is.
It's the prison within the prison.
Yes, it is. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. So family plays a big role, and support plays a big role. It sounds like education played a big role too.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that for the last part of this interview, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the role that education played in your success. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. I guess, you know, the thing that's important about education is really not the things that you learn in class. Mm-hmm. It's the people that you meet, you know. And it's like when you are surrounded, you know, birds of a feather flock together. So when you are surrounded by people that's heading in a positive direction, you know, the people, you know, that have the courage to dream even while inside a prison, you know, because, you know, we're told about the things that we can't do. You got the X on your back. When you get out, you're going to be denied this. You're going to be rejected here, rejected there. But in that schoolhouse, you know, you got a whole bunch of guys in there that's just dreaming. When I get out, I'm starting my own business. When I'm going to get out, and you know, I don't care anything about those obstacles. You know, I'm going to overcome, you know, whatever come my way. And that's generally the attitude of most people that are there, because you're paying your money to get this education, and you got a plan for what you're going to do with that education. Mm-hmm. You know, and so to me, it wasn't about the classes, you know, that I took, but it was the people that I met, because they also encouraged me and motivated me to dream. That, look, you know, I was incarcerated when I was 12 years old. You know, when I get out, don't place no limitations on the things that I can do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also learned there in education about accountability, you know, to be accountable. I had a lot of professors that came in from the outside that was part of the colleges to teach us. Now, they always teach about accountability, you know, and you learn that unless you hold yourself accountable for the things you've done, you know, then you can't move past those things. You know, I have to be accountable for, you know, for my actions, and accountable for my future. You know, so my actions in the present, I learned in school that, you know, my actions in the present are going to affect my future. You mm-hmm. know, with this education that I'm getting right now, you know, it's going to put me in a position, you know, to see once I get out. And so the greatest thing about getting an education in prison is about the, you know, the people that you're around, the people that you're going to learn from. You know, it's going to rub off on you. It's guaranteed. You know, and that's why, you know, research shows that people that are in prison that receive higher levels of education are the least likely to recidivate. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's a very, very good environment. And if people do have loved ones that are incarcerated, I encourage you, you know, to tell your loved ones, you know, to get involved in school, regardless of, you know, of what their scores are, or how they, you know, how hard they may feel like the work is. The greatest benefit that's going to come out of that are the people that they're going to meet while they're pursuing their education.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. You've been out since January 2019?
Yes, I got
congratulations.
Out. Congratulations. Thank you. Yeah. I just got off parole a week ago.
And you were just off of parole just recently. That's amazing. So what are your plans for the future?
My plans for the future is, you know, to stay on this grind as far as, you know, trying to impact people's lives in a positive way. You know, my theme is that, you know, we take something that was destructive, you know, and meant to destroy people, and we turn it into something, you know, that's empowering, you know, and to help people to learn from, you know, the destructive nature of violence, you know, destructive nature of terrible choices. And so what I want to do is that I just want to try, I want to tell my story, you know, and show people that, look, you know, no child is beyond redemption. I want to affect policy. I'm going to be a juvenile justice advocate, you know, until I die. You know, mm-hmm. and so I want to use my story, you know, to impact people's lives in a positive way, and not allow, you know, this terrible thing that I committed, you know, just be the last thing that people remember me for, but also bring something positive out of their terrible situation.
That's great. It sounds like your family played a big role in your success. Yes. It sounds like the church did too. The church really mattered to your family a lot.
Yes.
And education too. So.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story. Terrence, if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to reach you to find out more about the advocacy work that you're doing now, or you know, learn about your board game, where can they find out about you?
They can go to Terrence Sampson, my Facebook page, TerrenceSampson, mm-hmm. or they can go to my profile page, TD Sampson, mm-hmm. you know, T as in Terrence, D as in Deron Sampson, and you can see my day-to-day activities, and be on the lookout for the website AIM Project, AYMproject.com. It's coming soon.
AYM Project, great. So we've been talking tonight with Terrence Sampson. Terrence was incarcerated when he was 12 years old and served a 29-year sentence in the state of Texas. And has done some really amazing things while he was in prison. Thank you so much, Terrence.
You wrote
two books. Now you're out here traveling in the Northwest, educating folks about your story. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for letting
me Great.
Come on your show.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night.
All right.
Baby, you understand me now.
If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 7 o'clock. Coming up is Hard Knock Radio, but first, these words.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to Fire campaign and protest on Wednesday, January 15th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland. The Feet to Fire campaign is part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit. This peaceful protest happens every month outside of a different county courthouse and calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes, particularly those who were in a mental health crisis when they were killed by police. Again, that's Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Wednesday, January 15th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse, 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy,